In today's episode of Crypto Over Coffee, we're talking about my Bitcoin predictions. And in fact, as you know, Bitcoin usually carries the crypto market where it needs to go. So my Bitcoin predictions are going to likely bridge to my crypto predictions for 2024 and maybe even slightly beyond that into 2025. So the way we're going to structure this video is I'm going to sort of talk stream of consciousness on my ideas for the catalysts or drivers for Bitcoin to really thrive in 2024. And also I'm going to talk about some of the wild cards, the things that could cause problems for Bitcoin in 2024. So we're going to look at the bull case, and we're going to look at the bear case, and we're going to reconcile those two things and think about what is actually going to happen and how you can prepare for whatever does happen in 2024. And then I'm also going to, towards the end of the video, if we have some time, talk about a project I've done a little bit of research on now based on the community asking for it. So make sure you stick around for that. And if you want me to research one of your favorite projects, leave it in the YouTube comments or send it to me on X. My handle is at Hishoshi4. So let's get started. Bitcoin. It's been around for well over a decade now. It is a known commodity, literally and figuratively. And we just recently got a plethora of regulated ETF products that give a whole bunch of people access to Bitcoin that traditionally haven't really had access to it or made it easier for them to get it. So they don't have to worry about having exposure to the units. They can just go and buy the ETF just like any old stock, any old ETF of years past. And this is great, right? People think and people have thought, in the wake of the ETF, it's instant up only. It's going to be a buy, institutional FOMO. We're going to the moon. Didn't really pan out like that. Where we sit today, Bitcoin is at $46,000-$47,000. It's been ranging in that $44,000 to $46,000 for a little while now. And that's really good. But we, right after that ETF, sort of had that sell the news event. We shaved off quite a bit of value from Bitcoin, and now we're starting to see that strength building back up. But what happens now? Now that we have these ETFs, is that the only catalyst that we need? Let's talk about that. The ETF, in my view, what it is it is a vehicle for exposure to capital for Bitcoin that is largely not been able to capture, at least not directly in terms of Bitcoin units. Traditionally speaking, for institutions, in particular those who service different funds or service in, you know, customers, it's really difficult, or it was really difficult, to get exposure to Bitcoin for their clients because there were only really futures products. So the Grayscale Bitcoin futures product, which is not really great and actually is more risky and more difficult to navigate and harder to work with than these ETF, the spot products that allow you to get exposure based basically at the spot price of Bitcoin. But I digress. And then there was also the mechanism of allowing those people to effectively just buy their own units. And the same thing goes for corporations, businesses, pension funds, etc. Them getting access or exposing some of their capital to Bitcoin on a unit by unit basis was extremely difficult before. Mostly due to policy, not due to the actual difficulty of getting it. You can get Bitcoin basically anywhere. But for these organizations, these institutions, it's not like they fire up Coinbase and just say, okay, I want 10 Bitcoin. They might have to have a custody strategy. They might have to have a policy in place where they can only buy assets through these particular channels. So there's a whole mess of things that go into that. With these spot ETFs, it basically means that policy is still a factor. I've spoken to some folks who work in financial advisory and in wealth management, et cetera, and their organizations, these are larger organizations, still are saying, hey, listen, we're not allowed to do this for retirement customers, or we're not allowed to do this for specific tiers of wealth, et cetera. And that's just a risk thing. But I expect those to start to wean off. And then you will start to see wealth management, financial advisors, pension funds, retirement funds, allowing people access to Bitcoin spot ETFs directly. And you will start to see the marketing of this as a tool to insulate oneself from all the uncertainty that we have around the world right now, and in particular in the United States, with just all these political issues that we have, economic issues that we have, that I could do 20 videos just about that, but obviously that's not what this channel is about. And I think that's going to create the appetite, the uncertainty, the vitriol and division in an election year. And you pair that with the narratives around Bitcoin, the halving, the cyclical bull run, the sort of degradation of global fiat currencies, pushing people towards non-state, non-sovereign assets. You know, these are the catalysts that will get people thinking about, hey, you know, maybe I should be exposed to Bitcoin, you know, just as a hedge. And that's how it starts. It's just as a hedge, and then that allocation grows. And a lot of you, I'm sure, that are sitting here watching this video may have started out like that. It's a, you know, let me just kick the tires up. I'll put 1% of my net worth into Bitcoin. You know, I'll keep my stocks. I'll keep these other investments. Maybe I got a little real estate, whatever. Great. And I'll mix it up like that. And then maybe that allocation started to grow. And now you are predominantly in Bitcoin and crypto for any of the reasons or different reasons than I just mentioned. That's how it's going to start, in my view, for that institutional FOMO in 2024. And the reason why I think this happens in 2024, or at least starts to happen in 2024, is because people are going to want to try and front run all of the question marks, all the uncertainty, and insulate themselves from all the uncertainty of the election period. This is one of the ugliest, or one of the most toss-up, mystery, confusing, and frankly, kind of scary election years that I remember, at least in my lifetime, because we really don't know what's going to happen. And it really seems like no matter which way we go, things look relatively bleak in the United States. And so that, to me, is going to drive people, especially those with lots of wealth, to try and look for places to protect that wealth. And Bitcoin, that's where the story is. And I think that's why we saw the timing that we saw with all these massive institutions and asset managers creating these ETF products this year, and well, I guess towards the end of last year in 2023, because that is the story. They are salespeople first and foremost. They are trying to sell these products because that is how they make money. They collect assets and they bring assets under management by creating compelling stories about why people should be exposed to specific assets. That is no secret. And that is the sales machine that I think is going to start kicking off in 2024. It's get exposure to this thing. It's like digital gold. It's not associated with a single country. It's got a fixed supply. Look how it's done over the years. Look at its past performance, with the asterisk, past performance or historical performance does not inform future performance. It's not a predictor of future performance. You know, you get the idea. But that is the marketing that's going to go into it. And that is good for Bitcoin. It's hard to argue that that is good for Bitcoin from a price perspective. Let's make that very clear. Now, there is the counterpoint to this, right? So it's first the positive thing. Asset managers, institutions create institutional FOMO. We're in an election year. We have uncertainty. That means people are going to bite on the Bitcoin narrative. That means money flows into Bitcoin. Market cap goes up. It's scarce supply. Lots of that supply is in cold storage in the hands of individuals and et cetera. That means the number goes up, right? That's the good part. The bad part is that this also means that we have a potential large consolidation of power in the Bitcoin space in these asset managers. We already saw, and I can't remember the exact number, but it's a single digit percent, but still relatively concerning, single digit percent supply allocation in the hands of BlackRock already. It was some 40 some thousand Bitcoin units exposed to BlackRock and then their control. And I think that concerns me as a proponent of decentralized networks and Bitcoin remaining that way. Those who hold a large majority of coins do have more sway in the network. It's not a proof of stake network, so it's not quite the same, but consolidation of power is definitely a concern. The other thing is mining, right? That's the other big question mark. So let's look at that other, that sort of other counter case. You know, we think, okay, funds are going to roll into Bitcoin. It's going to drive the price of Bitcoin up because of institutional FOMO and the retail FOMO that follows. Good. The consolidation of power amongst institutions and asset managers because they hold tons of units of Bitcoin, and slowly but surely that FOMO through these ETF products will likely drive even more supply into their hands. The other part of this is the SEC and a lot of other regulators and people in Congress, Senator Elizabeth Warren, have made it very clear that they are anti-Bitcoin, right? They do not like Bitcoin. They think it's a threat to national security. They think that it's a it's an environmental hazard. Whatever the narrative of the day is, whether it's factual or not, doesn't really matter. There are enemies of this particular asset. That is just the truth. Now, the SEC lost a major battle with regard to the classification of Bitcoin and how it is looked at as an asset. It is a commodity. It has now been well stated. The launch of these Bitcoin ETF products basically confirms it is a commodity. So we have that sort of settled. We know that that is the case. The thing that I'm trying to get across now is that that's not the last battleground to attack Bitcoin from those who are anti-Bitcoin. There is the environmental piece, which I think we've actually done a really good job as a community fighting against and saying we are taking what would otherwise be completely wasted energy from the grid or from methane production, etc., and we are utilizing it so that it goes towards something with economic value. And that's a fair argument. We also have a trend line showing renewable energy use for Bitcoin mining going up and up and up and up. So I think we can win that one. The one we need to fight even harder is this notion that Bitcoin is for criminals. Because if you look at the actual data and you look at the data even from the US Treasury Department, they found that that is actually not the case. The majority of use of Bitcoin is not for nefarious purposes. But these things can be used to attack Bitcoin in a variety of ways. If Bitcoin mining is banned on environmental grounds, say in Congress in the United States, that is very harmful. There's a lot of hash power in the US, and that actually has a direct impact on Bitcoin and its security. So and its issuance. So we need to be considering that as an attack vector. The second is an outright ban of Bitcoin. Now, I think that is very unlikely, but what I think they could do is create an environment where the only way you can get Bitcoin is through these ETFs. And in an environment with strict KYC and strict checks, and you will not be allowed self-custody. That is the attack vector on the other side of it. Not an outright ban of Bitcoin, because I don't think that's attainable, but a ban of self-custody Bitcoin, I think, is potentially attainable. That would be destructive to the price of Bitcoin, and it would have ripple effects throughout the rest of crypto. So those are two things we need to be thinking about as counter cases. Everyone wants to be bullish, and I get that, and I am bullish, but you have to think about the opposite side of it. What could happen that invalidates my bull case? And those are two things: the consolidation of power in Bitcoin and the regulatory and sort of legislative perspective towards Bitcoin. On the positive side as well for Bitcoin, let's flip back to a positive thing, a bullish thing. It is a halving year. And a halving year, generally speaking, is a really, really positive thing for Bitcoin. A halving year, for those uninitiated, if you're watching this video, you probably know what a halving is, but just for the sake of everyone, so we're all on the same page, a halving is essentially a cyclical, certain number of blocks. Every certain number of blocks, the Bitcoin protocol halves the amount of inflation or issuance of Bitcoin supply. And people get very confused about inflation. They're like, wait, I thought Bitcoin is a fixed supply. Inflation is really just about issuance. It's inflation of the circulating supply of Bitcoin, and that only happens as new blocks are mined and that miner wins a block reward for mining that block. That is the issuance in Bitcoin, and it is to a fixed cap. But the inflation is X number of Bitcoin are released into circulation by way of block making and mining, and that's the only way the new supply is issued. And so in that, you have over time a halving or a reduction thereabouts every 4 years of the issuance that happens on a block per block basis. And so 6.25 Bitcoin per block goes to 3 Bitcoin per block, give or take. And that is the most important thing, 3.125 to be specific. And that is the most important thing for people to be thinking about, is it puts even more constraint on the circulating supply of Bitcoin when demand is fixed. Not as the most important part. When demand is fixed or rising, this has a positive price pressure. Now, there are environments and there are times when the halving does not have an immediate effect, and it takes some time for that to take hold. But on a fundamental level, that is the idea behind it. And that's the reason in many cases why we have this 4-year cycle in crypto or 4-year cycle in Bitcoin before the larger crypto market was even a thing, that cyclical halving puts a lot of pressure on the circulating supply of Bitcoin. It makes Bitcoin more scarce fundamentally. Miners don't even have as much Bitcoin to sell on the open market. And usually that also puts pressure on the equilibrium price of Bitcoin. And what I mean by the equilibrium price of Bitcoin is that the costs of mining as difficulty grows, so as hash rate grows, the difficulty, meaning the compute power required to mine a block, generally increases. Now, it's not necessarily linear, but it increases. That means the cost to mine increases generally. And when the cost to mine increases, it means that the cost of, or the price of Bitcoin needs to adjust accordingly for miners to make a profit. And so you usually will see that equilibrium price start to take effect. So when the halving happens, it means on a unit by unit basis, miners are getting less Bitcoin per block mined. That reward is lower, meaning it completely changes the game. They are getting half the Bitcoin units that they were before for mining, and the costs are probably static. So the price of Bitcoin needs to adjust to make mining profitable. And we have seen that happen in years past. That is a major economic driver for Bitcoin's price to increase. And people don't often talk about it, but it is. Now, it can go the other way too, where miners' costs reduce or hash rate drastically reduces, and price is super high, miners start selling in higher volumes because they want to make as much profit as possible on those Bitcoin units. And they don't always sell them on the open market when they get them. But anyways, we could spend a whole video just talking about the economics of mining and how miners behave and what drives them and miner concentrations, etc. That's not what this video is about. The whole point of what I was just saying is that equilibrium price driver is another thing that could drive Bitcoin's price into those zones people talk about, you know, the 100K Bitcoin zone, right? If you think about it, Bitcoin right below 50K, we're talking about that. Mining is relatively profitable. The halving happens. Now miners get 3.125 Bitcoin, not 6.25. Now, what does that say to you? Generally, it says Bitcoin's price needs to go up so that mining is still profitable. Security of the network depends on it. Here's what happens. You start to track towards that new profitability level. And that's why you usually see price floors in bear markets being set as well, because mining drives a lot of the price floor for Bitcoin as well. That is my belief. And that is what, at least looking at the data, I've started to find. It's not a perfect metric, but it's one to watch. So I believe that the combination of scarcity through the Bitcoin halving, a large concentration of people holding Bitcoin dormant, which you can see on chain very clearly. Number two, the demand for block space in the form of inscriptions, which we'll not talk about deeply here, but it's something that is a factor in the long term of Bitcoin, as well as institutional and then retail FOMO through the Bitcoin ETFs and the narratives around hedging against global economic uncertainty and geopolitical uncertainty as well. That will drive a lot of the excitement in Bitcoin. And we could see Bitcoin go well beyond everyone's sort of mental model for where they think Bitcoin could go. I'm not going to give a number necessarily, but I'm going to give you a range. I do believe that we could see Bitcoin going well above the 6-digit mark. So that 100K mark we've been talking about now for, I think, 4 years, probably maybe 5. And it could reach as high as, barring some sort of unforeseen circumstance, 250,000. I think people calling for $1 million are nuts. I think the only way we get to 250 is just basically by way of currency value meeting it halfway, basically inflation making Bitcoin worth more in dollars than before. So that's what I'm betting on. Now, if it goes higher, great. If it goes lower, then what? If we never get to that point, then what? If you have a plan, then you're not super worried about that. So what I would say now is, with all this information, and hopefully this makes you go look at charts, go look at historical data, look at other things that may inform your thesis for what happens with Bitcoin. I want you to do more research. That's why I don't want to give you all the answers and give you everything. I give you all my thoughts, and hopefully that inspires you to do your own research as well. What I would suggest you do is sit down now and make a plan for 2024. If Bitcoin hits this value, what do I do? Do I hold? Am I in Bitcoin for 10, 20, 30, 40 years? Or do I need this money out because I've bet money I can't lose? Do I need this money out because if I used that money for something else, like digging out of debt, it would have a much bigger impact on my life than in a 10-year timescale getting another big bounce in price? Those are the things that you need to be thinking about right now before we get all the crazy price action, before we get all of the crazy speculation and people doing Twitter threads about how Bitcoin's going to $2 million, which will not happen in this cycle, in my personal opinion. It's going to be a lot harder to remain objective when the price is ripping like crazy. It's the same reason why when people were saying the ETF's a sell the news event and we went up to 50K and then down to 38K Bitcoin, and people were like, oh, I guess I got carried away. It's exactly what's going to happen again after the halving in a bull market. You have to have a plan now versus making a plan later so that you can remain objective and hold yourself accountable. But what does this mean for the rest of the crypto market? That's what a lot of people want to know, and that's what a lot of people are going to be thinking about. In years past, what has generally happened is the bull market kind of goes in these little waves where money rolls into Bitcoin, Bitcoin rips way up, then you see a little bit of a dip as money cycles from Bitcoin into altcoins and into niche altcoin sectors. And I have a feeling that's likely what's going to happen this year. The difference is that we're going to see smaller dips in Bitcoin because it's going to be largely retail money that is moving in these Bitcoin shifts, profit-taking cycles. It's going to be people moving from Bitcoin into L1 chains, and then from L1 chains into L2s, and then altcoins in their ecosystems. And so this year, if we have a thesis that institutional dollars are going to drive a lot of the adoption, those institutional dollars are likely not going to roll from Bitcoin into L1s, into like gaming altcoins, right? That's probably not going to happen. So we'll see something slightly different this year if our thesis, or I guess my thesis, plays out the way I think it will. Institutional dollars are not going to behave the same way as retail dollars necessarily. So think about that as well as you make your plan. I'm not saying altcoins aren't going to do well. They will, I have a feeling, but it's going to look different. So looking at old patterns may not work as well as they did in years past because of the differences in the space right now. The other thing you have to think about too is that same regulatory and legislative perspective in this space. In the US and in other Western societies, especially like we saw already in the East, there is potential for outright bans or extremely restrictive regulations to be put into place that create access problems for altcoins or compliance problems for altcoins. We've seen some rumblings around registration for people who provide liquidity to DeFi protocols or participate in staking. Those are completely unrealistic and impossible to comply with regulations in the US, for example, that if passed would have a real effect on the altcoin projects or the L1s to which they pertain. So you have to keep that in your mind as well, watching very closely the regulatory perspective that's going on in the country that you live in, but not just the country you live in, globally, because global regulation matters no matter where you live with regard to crypto. The market's small enough right now that it really does still matter. So that's my perspective on what's going to happen with Bitcoin. I think despite the potential bear cases, the things that could happen that could derail everything, I think that the confluence of the geopolitical and economic uncertainty and concern people have looking for a hedge, the institutional FOMO that's likely to follow as the marketing machine moves for the Bitcoin ETFs on those narratives, and then the retail FOMO that follows, mixed with the halving and the supply constriction that comes with it, I think you have a recipe for significant Bitcoin price appreciation into the six-figure mark. That is my belief, and I think that carries the altcoin prices, the broader crypto market, way up with it as we see value cycling from Bitcoin into other ecosystems as well. And speaking of other ecosystems, I promised, and it might be a little bit jarring, but I did promise that I would talk a little bit about an ecosystem that I've been looking at, or a project, not an ecosystem, a project that I took a quick look at, and I will do some more research on it, but I want to make good on my word because I said I would look at it, and I did. The Radix community was tagging me like crazy on X and asking me to take a look at it because I've talked about in my last video or one of my last videos about user experience being one of the biggest aspects of driving adoption in this next cycle. And the Radix community says, well, listen, we're all about DeFi. We've built this chain. We've built a scripting language. We've built easy to use UX to onboard people into DeFi primitives. And Radix is great. So I decided to take a quick look at it and see what it was all about. And I'll give you my initial thoughts. I'm not going to do this as an explainer, but what I will tell you is if you would like one, let me know in the comments on Twitter or sorry, X, and I will consider doing one. So Radix, hyper-focused on DeFi and to be a sort of simple, trusted gateway into the world of DeFi. And it's not necessarily a walled garden in the sense that it has no connection to the outside world, but it puts up these guardrails to make it a little easier, a little safer, and a little better for people who may not want to go into degen mode, fire up MetaMask, dig into the code of some, you know, new hot points offering DeFi protocol or DEX. They just want to access DeFi primitives. They want lending, they want DEXs, they want maybe prediction markets. They want all this stuff and they want to do it in an easy way. And Radix put together a chain and an environment to do that, which is important, right? You need all the basics, scalability, all of that. But what I think the most important thing is they made improvements in two major areas. Number one, they made it really easy to access and to use those DeFi products. So the user experience around the wallet being kind of mobile first, based on my look at this particular project, being mobile first, kind of following the same pattern what Multiverse X has done with the former MyR, now XPortal wallet, being mobile first and letting people do basically everything they want to do from their phone in a really, really well-crafted user interface makes a lot of sense. That is likely how people are going to interact with DeFi from here on out. You see that now in the trend with like Phantom Wallet, for example, MetaMask has created mobile apps. That's probably what's going to happen in the future. Everyone's going to interact with these things from mobile. So that's good. The most important thing, the thing that appeals to me the most, is the scripting language. I think Scripto, maybe it was. Maybe I'm misremembering now, but I think that's what it is. And it's basically an expressive language for creating digital asset related products, right? And it has really interesting decisions that were made. And I don't say interesting in a negative way. What I think is the most appealing about it is they've taken a lot of the lessons learned from the Ethereum ecosystem. They've taken a lot of lessons learned from others and brought that into the builder focused set of tools. I saw some interesting conversations on X where developers, you know, maybe it was on Reddit too, developers talking about how easy it was for them to build out their DeFi project idea. They did it through a hackathon. They took these tools. They used concepts like digital asset containers and just these modular components that makes it a lot easier to be able to build DeFi projects and to implement what they're looking to implement. And the focus on developer tooling, and I've talked about this in previous videos, if you make it easy for developers to build things, and more importantly, you make it easy for developers to build things properly and to build it with security, make it more difficult to make decisions that affect the user, negatively that is, the better off you are. The easier it is for builders to build, the easier it is to bring in users. The more builders build, more users come. The more users that come, the more builders build. And you have now this cycle that benefits your particular project. And so I did a little bit of searching. Maybe I'll do a little bit of tinkering and development myself and see how actually easy it is just beyond looking at it and looking at the materials, how actually easy it is to go from ideation to a product. And I don't have a ton of leftover time, but maybe I will do that. But Radix Pretty impressed with what I saw based on the initial look that I did. I do owe a much deeper dive into this particular stuff, and I will leave a link. Hopefully I'll remember, but I will leave a link in the description to the specific pages for developer tooling. So for those of you who are more technically inclined, I only scratched the surface because I'm trying to make this video accessible to everyone. But if you're more development inclined, please head to those links, take a look for yourself, tell me what you think. Drastically different approach than, say, Solidity. Drastically different approach than, say, Plutus, that Haskell-based language in Cardano. It's very unique, is what I will say. So take a look. Let me know what you think. Thank you to the Radix community for pointing this out to me. I'm going to do a deeper dive, but I figured I would shout it out, let you know I am taking a look at it. I have taken a look at it, and I will continue to do so. So with that, we've been talking for probably close to, if not over 30 minutes now, which is the target for the show. So thank you very much for sticking around until the end of the video, as always, or the podcast if you're listening to the show instead of watching the show. I appreciate you equally. Thanks very much. I hope you and your family have a wonderful weekend. And until next time, cheers.